Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is the Healthy Mind Podcast. Here, we talk about our emotional health and well-being, about living the most authentic life we possibly can, the one we truly deserve. So take notice, our true strength and action are on the march, while our fears and self-doubt are on the run. Never doubt how truly powerful you are. Let's learn together, right here on The Healthy Mind. Oh, yes. Well, welcome, everyone. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is The Healthy Mind Podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. I hope you've had a good week. I've got a really, really great podcast for you today. We're going to be talking about fear, and how it trips us up, from really achieving the things that we want to do, the success that we want, the potential that we want, and what we can do to tame it and hopefully conquer it. But I'm going to come at it from a different perspective here. I'm going to tell you a little bit of a story here about how a diving board can teach us a lot about fear. Lessons from a diving board today on the Healthy Mind Podcast in news, and you're really going to want to stick around for the second half of the podcast. Really, a real interesting week for news. First off, does stress affect your brain cells? Going to kill your brain cells? Well, you are going to be surprised at the answer. Some really stunning research from the UK at King's College London. And also, researchers at the University of North Carolina have identified a biological basis, a signal that might be helpful in predicting which individuals will suffer from chronic pain after they've had a trauma or a really stressful event. Wow, some really, really interesting research coming out of the University of North Carolina. You're going to want to hear this. We'll do some headlines, and heck, we've got ourselves a pretty good podcast. I'm really happy that you're here. So, are you ready? Let's begin. All right. Now, fear. Fear today on The Healthy Mind. And we've talked about it off and on here in various podcasts. But today, I want to talk about fear from a little bit different perspective. We know how fear can trip us up. This emotion, these feelings that scare us, that worry us, that prevent us from having a happier, a healthier, a more fulfilling life. Why? What is it about these feelings, these thoughts that can trip us up? And I want you, if you will, to travel down memory lane, Dr. Zafiridis's travels down memory lane, and where I am from in Northeast Ohio in Youngstown, where I grew up. And our family belonged to a swimming club. It was really a pool that we used to go to in the summers. Beautiful pools, a huge, huge pool, probably a couple Olympic-sized pools, maybe three. Just this long, long pool. And they used to have swimming tournaments there and diving tournaments there. But it was this long, long pool. And smack dab about the midway point, going off kind of like a perpendicular, almost like a letter T, was the diving area. Deep part of the pool, 15 feet. Three dives, different lengths. The low dive that I called it, probably a couple feet. The medium dive, maybe about 4 feet. And then the big kahuna, 12 feet in the air, 12 feet in the air. And oh, when I first saw those, especially that high dive, man, whew, I'd learned to swim, but there was something about that high dive that just terrified me. And it really got to me because some of my best friends there, a guy named Zach and a guy named Dan, they would go off this dive like it was nobody's business. Jumping, they'd go another 3 or 4 feet beyond the dive in the air. They'd come down, cannonballs, dives. It was incredible. And here's me sitting on the side of the pool, terrified to go up those steps. Well, it was one summer early on when we belonged there, and I was going to tackle it. I just didn't want this fear to get in my way. Now, the low dive, no problem. I got up there, even though I remember the first time I ever went off of it in the deep end, it was a little bit intimidating, but that was fairly simple. And then the medium dive, maybe a few days later, a couple weeks later, but oh, that high dive, 12 feet in the air. And to me, it looked like I was going to be jumping off a cliff. And I had this picture of just getting up there. Either I'd be paralyzed, I wouldn't be able to do it, and then I'd be embarrassed. I'd have to come down the steps leading up to the diving board. Or I would make it. I would jump off, and then I would fall forever, hit the water, and then something bad would happen. I'd either just be moving so fast that I'd hit the bottom of the pool, maybe break my ankle, who knows what, or I'd get to the bottom of the pool and then I wouldn't have enough air and I wouldn't be able to make it to the top. This is what I was thinking of for weeks, and I wouldn't go off that high dive. Didn't matter what people said, didn't matter the encouragement, I just couldn't do it. Well, until I did. I remember it clearly. It was towards the end of the summer, and the later afternoon, it was the best time to be there if you didn't want a whole lot of people around. People were going back to their homes to have dinner or what have you. So there we were. And if I was going to be embarrassed, make a fool of myself, might as well do it when there's not a lot of people around. So up the steps I go. And I remembered people telling me, if you're scared about that high dive, don't look down. Don't waste your time walking over, looking at the pool, and futzing around up there. Just get up there, run, and jump off. So I got my nerve up. I got to the top. It was so tempting to look down, but I didn't. I remember running. I took that jump well up a couple, 3 feet in the air. And it seemed like it went on forever. I remember going up, looking over the roof into the parking lot from the entrance to the swimming pool. And then it felt like I dropped for, I don't know, half an hour. Felt like forever. And then I hit the water. I didn't go down to the bottom. Not even close. Maybe my head went under a foot or so. Within a second, I was up. Within 2 seconds, I'm off to the edge of the pool. I conquered the high dive. I had done it, and it was amazing, and I couldn't wait to do it again, and I did do it again the rest of that summer. I was a little bit nervous the first few times, but it was gone. I was able to jump, and when I would do it again, the water didn't take a half hour to get there. I was gone. I hated just how short it was. Go off, within a second I'm in the water, within another couple seconds I'm out. I was loving it. But there was that first time. There was the thoughts behind that first time. I'm going to jump off that dive. I'm going to be moving so fast on the way down that I'm going to shoot through that water as fast as I possibly can, hit the bottom of the pool, maybe shatter an ankle, or I'm not going to have enough time to make it to the surface of the water because I don't have enough air. Now, it sounds silly. Sounds rather silly, and it's kind of silly for me to even say it, but that's what I felt. That's the power of fear. Prevented me from doing that almost that entire summer. Doesn't matter that it was irrational. It stopped me from doing it. Okay, so why did you just go down Peter Zafiridis's adolescent memory lane? Well, I think of that a lot when I'm talking to people about fear and anxiety. I may even use that example when it's appropriate. Now, I'm not trying to liken my experience off the high dive to someone's severe anxiety and panic, but the themes there, the fact that we can incorporate these fears, these automatic thoughts, these cognitive distortions, and their thoughts, their feelings, their emotions, they prevent us from acting. And it doesn't matter if the thoughts are irrational or the likelihood of the worst happening is never going to happen. It's the thought of that, the thought, the fear that prevents us from acting. And on a more typical example, in my practice, people will come in with anxiety, fear, things that they worry about, anxiety attacks or panic attacks. And we talk about the settings. Maybe someone's afraid to go into a store, a large building where there's a lot of people, for fear of having an anxiety attack or not being able to leave. It doesn't really matter the thoughts and the irrationality of it in terms of having a panic attack. It's enough to stop people and impair their lives. When I talk to individuals about it, they say they're terrified of having an anxiety attack because of the way it's made them feel before, that they feel like they're going to pass out or throw up or, in extreme examples, maybe even die if they have a panic attack. But they can pull back and realize that they're not going to die from anxiety. But it's enough if they're worried about feeling very badly. But when I push it further, I say, well, you have a panic attack and you feel badly, but then it ends. It ends. There's a limited amount of time that it happens, and people agree. Well, what if someone sees me? What if I make a fool of myself? Well, what if someone, though, is compassionate and caring? Let's put the shoe on the other foot. What if you saw someone having that anxiety attack? What would you do? Would you ridicule them? No, they say. To a person, I would try to do my best to help them if they're uncomfortable. What could I do to help them? And I'd feel good about it. Why wouldn't someone help you? And people stop. But even though they stop and think about it, that may not be enough. And don't get me wrong here. I am not suggesting that my simple challenge of those automatic assumptions that one time is somehow magically going to make years of panic or anxiety go away. I'm not being that presumptuous, and I'm not that good in terms of getting rid of anxiety in that way. But it is important for all of us, not just in clinical extreme examples of panic and anxiety, but in common fears and worries that limit us, that we've got to understand, one, where they come from, two, that they're distortions in our thinking, and they might be irrational, and that three, we can push past them. In fact, the only way to get past them is through them. To not let them limit you. These cognitive distortions that happen, these fears, these worries, these anxieties, they're not concrete walls that we can't move past. They're paper. They're paper. We can push on them, and they can get out of our way. This is why I say it's not just a tagline here at The Healthy Mind. Never doubt how truly powerful you are, because you are. All I see every day are individuals that have the strength and the resilience and the perseverance to show up for life. Despite the adversity, despite the challenges that they have emotionally, they push through and carve out a life. To me, that is strength. Despite how badly they feel, that is strength. And there's important lessons there for all of us, because hopefully you don't face that kind of panic and anxiety. But if fears are getting in your way, what are they? Take the time to literally think about that process of thinking that leads to that fear, that leads to that inaction. Challenge it. Challenge it. See if it's irrational. See if it doesn't make sense. And then push through it. Push through it. They're just fears. They're just emotions. And even though we're wired to survive, of course, and we have to think about the worst in an uncertain situation, what could happen? What would happen? What will happen? It rarely, if ever, turns out as bad as we can imagine. And oftentimes it's not even close to that. I go back to my high dive example, right? It prevented me for a summer from enjoying it. But for whatever reason, whatever happened, the stars aligned, who knows, I did it. And that fear evaporated after that. What I thought was going to happen, the hypothetical, got replaced by what did happen, the actual. And that's where it is so important to push through the fear, even if it's uncomfortable, because it sends your body an incredibly potent and powerful message that you can. That you can move through that. And it puts that fear on notice. Now, if you're struggling with a lot of anxiety or there is a barrier there and you don't feel you can do it on your own, get help. Get help. Get someone to help you. Get a counselor or a friend, a group of people that can help you. But do it. Don't be intimidated by your fear, because the difference between people who succeed, and I'm not talking about money and finances only, educationally, professionally, in relationships, in health, are the people that persevere. The people that show up and push through it, despite the fact that it might be bad, because it rarely is as bad as we can imagine. And the worst thing that is going to happen is that we fail. Big deal. Get in line. But we learn from failure. We learn from failure. And at the very least, we learn that adversity and fear won't intimidate us. Push forward. Just keep pushing forward. When we can tame fear in that way, when you do that, oh, things begin to change. And believe me, they change fast. You'll see. You will see. And when you begin to see that, well, that is a powerful, powerful step that you've just taken on your road to a healthy mind. And now it's time for news. Okay, well, a very, very interesting and busy week of health news. This first story comes from the UK, King's College London. And researchers there have identified a stress protein. And this stress protein reduces new brain cell production, and it's also linked to depression. Now, they had discovered this mechanism behind how stress hormones, cortisol that we've talked about before, and stress itself reduces the number of new brain cells. Did you know that stress can reduce the number of new brain cells in your brain right now? If you're stressed, it's happening. But this process is also thought to be linked to depression. They found this protein, and it's responsible for the long-term effects on the brain's ability to create new cells. What they also found was a compound, a drug compound, that can block this effect. And it's really exciting because it may open a new avenue, a new direction for us in the treatment of depression. And boy, boy, do we need it. The scope of the problem is, well, it's ominous. The World Health Organization has estimated by 2030 that depression will be the leading cause of the global burden of disease. And even though we've come a long, long way in the science of the brain and depression, our best attempts are still 60 to 65% of people who will respond. medications, therapy, and what usually is a combination of both. And we know, at least in the more recent research, that what happens to the brain during depression is, you can literally see it, parts of the brain begin to shrink. You lose the mass of certain parts of the brain, the actual substance. And it's thought to be due to a decreased production of new cells, what's known as neurogenesis, the creation of new cells. Now, on a biochemical basis, what's happening? Well, stress happens, and it's known to increase the levels of the stress hormone, cortisol. We've talked about that a ton here on The Healthy Mind. Cortisol then acts on a receptor known as the glucocorticoid receptor. How it happens to do this, they still don't know, but this leads to a decrease in neurogenesis, the creation of new cells. Well, what researchers did was study stem cells from a part of the brain that can regenerate itself. Not all parts of the brain can do this. The part of the brain that can is an area known as the hippocampus, the memory center of the brain. In fact, in research studies that have come out, you can actually see in patients who've been depressed, the size of the hippocampus shrinks. Now, when they looked at this, the effect of cortisol over time, they found that a protein called SGK1, remember that because there's going to be a quiz, was important in mediating and directing the effects of stress hormones on neurogenesis and the activity at that glucocorticoid receptor. And what they found was that when that protein is present, the effect of cortisol hitting on that receptor, the glucocorticoid receptor, echoes. It continues to echo on and on and on, even when cortisol has washed away from the receptor. It's like an echo chamber. Now, they also had identified a compound, a drug compound, long, long name. It's got a bunch of numbers in it. It doesn't really matter right now. It's in research. But what they found was it would block this whole process. And as a result, you would get the production of brain cells, neurogenesis. There's been serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine. That's what everyone has heard of in terms of the treatment of depression. This is completely different. And this is really exciting because, according to Dr. Christoph Anneker from King's College of London, quote, "This new mechanism may be particularly important for the effects of chronic stress on mood and ultimately depressive symptoms. Pharmacologic interventions aimed at reducing the levels of SKG1, that protein, in depressed patients may therefore be a potential strategy for future antidepressant treatments." You know, a lot of times people will come in and they'll say, gosh, isn't there anything new that is coming out for the treatment of depression and anxiety? And I want people to hold on to it because there's research being done everywhere, everywhere to try and find that next mechanism. And studies like this at King's College London may be the beginnings of a new treatment approach. Okay, for those of you who have listened to The Healthy Mind for any length of time, know that my particular area of interest in psychiatry is in the way people will manifest their emotional symptoms physically, how those emotions will come out in physical symptoms, particularly pain. Well, a new study out of the University of North Carolina finds that chronic pain after stressful events has a specific biological basis. They've identified a process biologically that this happens. The headline, "When stress causes pain, a genetic risk factor is identified." Now, what these researchers did, and it was the first of its kind to identify a genetic risk factor for chronic pain after someone has suffered a traumatic event, like a car accident or a sexual assault. amazing research that's been done. The lead author, Dr. Samuel McLean from the University of North Carolina, states, quote, our study findings indicate that mechanisms influencing chronic pain development may be related to the stress response rather than any specific injury caused by the traumatic event. And he went on to say that what they believe is happening here is that for some people, something goes wrong with the body's fight or flight response. And as a result, chronic pain will occur. So how did they find it? What is the details of all of this? Well, they studied this part of the body known as the HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. Well, this axis was responsible for the body's response to stressful events. And they wondered if this axis, this HPA axis, could influence the effect of chronic pain a few weeks after either a traumatic event like a motor vehicle accident or a sexual assault. So what did they find? The researchers found that there was a variation in the gene that codes for a certain protein called FKBP5. And what they found was that this particular protein plays a huge role in regulating this HP axis and its response to stress. They found that with this genetic variant, people who had this variant, that they had a 20% higher risk of moderate to severe pain 6 weeks after a motor vehicle accident. And the same type of risk, heightened risk, was found in those who had followed after a sexual assault. Huge implications as it relates to chronic pain. As Dr. McLean goes on to say, quote, right now, if someone comes into the emergency department after a car accident, we don't have any interventions to prevent chronic pain from developing. And the same thing happens in a woman who might come in after a sexual assault. You can eliminate the risk of STDs, make sure that she's not pregnant. But being able to predict which individual may go on to develop chronic and persistent pain, it's been hard. So this particular study may open the door in understanding which people may be at risk for persistent and chronic pain after a stressful event. And those of you that suffer with chronic pain know what I'm talking about. It's really, really hard. And this study may help to begin to bridge the gap, the mind-body gap as it relates to pain. Because the state of the art right now in medicine can't really predict who's at risk or not, oftentimes there's a stigma, there's a bias by those who treat, thinking that people are faking it or they're exaggerating it, maybe for financial gain or just having a psychological response. So improving the understanding of the biology like these types of findings may begin to bring some sense to why some people over others will develop chronic pain, particularly after a stressful or traumatic event. Okay, with the time that we have left, I just want to blast through the rest of the news in a segment I like to call the Healthy Mind Headlines. Okay, the first headline, the nocebo effect. Media reports may trigger symptoms of a disease. Media reports about substances that are supposedly hazardous to health may cause suggestible people to develop symptoms of a disease, even though there is no objective reason for doing so. This, according to a recent study of the phenomenon known as electromagnetic hypersensitivity. The next headline, don't text and drive. Teens are not getting the message. Teens can get hundreds of text messages a day, but one message they're not getting is that they shouldn't text and drive. Nearly 43% of high school students of driving age who were surveyed in 2011 reported texting while driving at least once in the past month. This, according to a study that was presented at the Pediatric Academy Society's national meeting in Washington, D.C. And finally, this one's great. It's spring. You should be getting out there anyway. The headline, sunshine could benefit health and prolong life. Exposing skin to sunlight may help reduce blood pressure, cut the risk of heart attack and stroke, and even prolong your life. This from researchers at the University of Edinburgh. Get out there in the sunshine. You need it for your vitamin D. Soak that up and turn all that vitamin D on. And according to this latest research, it may be a very, very heart healthy thing to do. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is just about going to do it for this week's podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. Many, many thanks to those of you who have been kind enough to rate the podcast at iTunes. If you have the time, I ask you that kindness. If you enjoy the program, if you like what you're hearing, please take a moment and rate the podcast for me at iTunes. You have no idea what just a few ratings do to the visibility and the reach of this show. I thank you in advance for doing that. It would really mean a lot to me. The website, as always, www.thehealthymind.com. And any questions or comments, I want to hear from you. Thank you for your incredible, incredible emails. They mean so much to me. You can email me at peter@thehealthymind.com. And for the Healthy Mind Podcast, part of the Healthy Mind Network, I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time right here on The Healthy Mind.